Indeed, indeed, with David Darling. What happens if we have an alien invasion? Let's get his take on that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. David, you're a believer in extraterrestrial life, aren't you? Intelligent extraterrestrial life?
Yes, I've written a lot about that, and I am a real optimist when it comes to that. Both life in the solar system and life throughout the galaxy, and intelligent life as well. I've always believed that life is a sort of imperative, a cosmic imperative, if you like, and that it's going to arise wherever it possibly can, and that ultimately, in many places, it will lead to intelligent life.
Do you think that intelligent life might resemble us in some form or fashion? Pretty close.
Well, I think that there are reasons to think there would be some similarity. Intelligent life, you would think, probably requires a brain, some organs to be able to perceive the environment, mm-hmm. something like eyes.
Fingers, hands, ears. All that.
Yeah, and it depends on the environment where it came about. If it was a higher gravity, lower gravity, slightly in different biochemistry, there would be variations, but the human design seems to be admirably suited to what it does. So you could imagine people with extra eyes or extra fingers or different. But somehow, if you're intelligent, you need to be able to pick up things, you need to be able to see things, you need to be able to move around. So a lot of the things is just sort of basic common physics, basic common sense, really. So I think nature will probably produce, in some cases, creatures that are similar to, certainly in a vague way, similar to us.
I'm going to take God out of the equation here for a moment, David, but how could, as you look at human beings, for example, or dogs or cats or frogs, how could they be designed to have eyes to see, a nose to smell, a voice to communicate, ears to hear? I mean, how could that be created that way? There's no mistake. I'm baffled by it.
Well, there have been mistakes along the way, and if you look at the fossil record, and again, I'm not a paleontologist, but certainly when life began to emerge from the single cell stage about 600 million years ago in what was called the Cambrian explosion, all of a sudden there was this sort of a riot of experimentation where you get more complex life forms. And you look at the fossil records and in those shale beds where these early multicellular animals were appearing on the Earth, you see some extraordinary creatures, creatures that they look like some sort of bizarre, wild imaginings of deranged mind. And they didn't survive. They were experiments that fell by on the wayside, the evolutionary wayside. And it was the ones that were best suited to survival that progressed down. So the ones with the most useful legs, the most useful eyes, the most useful sensory apparatus, they're the ones that were able to adapt and multiply and provide future generations. The ones that were simply crazy ideas that nature threw up, they didn't make it. So it's not a sort of a straight line path, where all of a sudden, the nature thinks, oh, an eye would be a great idea, we'll produce an eye. There was a lot of crazy experimentation on the way, and we're sort of the end product of it after millions and millions of years.
Okay, so let's assume that there are similarities on other planets, but they're more advanced. Let's give them a million years more advanced than us. That's a pretty big jump start, assuming things progress at the same time scale, right?
That is absolutely enormous. A thousand years would be big, but a million years, you just got to look at how far we've come in the past 100 years.
That's right.
You go back to 1900, and we didn't have anything like powered aircraft, for example, computers.
Or even 2,000 years. Look at the advance there. What's also funny though, David, there was a period from, let's say, the days of Christ through 1200, 1300 years, 1400 AD, things really didn't change that much, did they?
No, and in some cases they went backwards. If you look at, for example, what the Romans were capable of. I've visited some Roman sites here in Britain, and they had sort of central heating systems. They had You know, they could heat their own homes. They were really, really advanced engineering-wise. And then we just went back into almost the Stone Age for centuries and centuries. And it wasn't, as you say, until the Renaissance period in the sort of 15th century, 16th century, things started to move ahead again. So there was that sort of period where things just stagnated, and the knowledge was basically lost, and then it was refound. Fortunately, records have been kept of what people have learned in the past, and we were able to start moving ahead again.
What clicked for mankind that just really got it jump-started? And when might that have been? Late 1800s, something like that?
Yeah, well, I suppose technology tends to build upon itself, and fortunately, the knowledge that the ancients had, the Greeks and whatnot, that was preserved by the Arabs, and then eventually found its way back into Europe again. That kicked off the Renaissance period with Galileo and Da Vinci, people like that, forging ahead, and the birth of scientific experimentation. And then, of course, in the sort of 18th century, you had the Industrial Revolution. Somebody, the invention of the steam engine, which allowed all sorts of new machinery to be powered, mass production of things, and all of a sudden it all started to build upon it, just as it's been building ever since. Once you've got those building blocks in place, then you can launch to the next level and the next level, providing it's not all knocked away. There's something like it, get back to the asteroid collision, something like that could all be wiped away. Just imagine all our computer records and books being destroyed.
God.
I often think if I personally was taken back in a time machine, say to the time of Christ or a couple of thousand years, what would I be able to do usefully to tell people? I'm not really a very practical kind of guy. I wouldn't be able to build a water pump or something like that. So what could I? It would be useless to tell them what an atom was, for example, because they wouldn't be able to do anything with it. So apart from some very basic knowledge, I'd be almost totally useless. Here I am, 21st century man, as an individual, without all the internet and all my records available to me, I'd be virtually useless. So it is surprising how this sort of accumulation of knowledge is so important to us.
Well,
that's true.
That's true. I mean, you'd be lucky if you got in during the period of Galileo. And you convinced him to build this apparatus to look at the planets and the moon and everything else.
Well, I think Galileo would be teaching me stuff, to be quite honest. I mean, his knowledge of optics would probably be greater than mine. And the best I could do would be to give him some sort of an idea of where things would progress in the future. And he might be able to take that on board himself. But some of these guys were really, really clever. They would have picked up on modern ideas very, very quickly if they'd had access to them. But it is surprising how we depend on what's around us. And once you're pulled out of that environment, you'd be pretty helpless. I would be pretty helpless. I know that.
Absolutely. And, it'd be just my luck to be around when Marconi was there and try to convince him to invent the radio. I'd have no idea technically how to do it.
Well, you'd still be putting your show out, I'm sure. But
yeah, absolutely. But those folks, then, all of them, they were geniuses.
They were really exceptional. When you think of the times they were working in, people like Da Vinci, look at Leonardo da Vinci's sketches, and he was centuries ahead of his time. I mean, at the time, they must have thought he was absolutely crazy, coming up with designs for submarines and helicopters and all these sort of things, which were technically beyond him. There's no way he could build them, but he knew that the concept existed. Just think what a guy like that would do today.
I wonder if they were time travelers. What do you think?
Sorry?
I wonder if they were time travelers, like Da Vinci.
Well, that thought has arisen, hasn't it, in science fiction, and it does make you wonder with people like him and people like Galileo, how they could be so far ahead of their time. I think it's a wonderful idea that I don't know whether it's true or not, or whether these people just are that visionary. I just can't imagine. You don't seem to get people like that today. Although I'm sure you do, it's just that they're working for big corporations. They're not sort of individuals. And in those days, it was possible for somebody like Galileo or Da Vinci to virtually carry all of human knowledge in their head because there wasn't much of it. So they could be super generalists. Whereas today, people tend to be specialists, so they don't show themselves as Renaissance men and women. But in those days, it was possible to stand out. But I think it is an interesting idea. I think it's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, it is. Let's take a few calls here, too, while we talk, David. Sam in Salt Lake City, Utah, you are up with us. Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, hello. I'm glad to get through today.
Super.
Well, I wanted to make a few points. First off, what you were talking about before the last break was that, you know, the scientists and geologists and archaeologists are out there for truth. Well, to quote from a book, Cycles and Cosmic Catastrophes, excellent book, but it goes into Clovis and pre-Clovis archaeology. And the guy doing the study basically came across many people that it put their careers, because the main scientists had built their careers off of one theory.
Okay.
But what it came down to is that they had a wall against pre-Clovis archaeology, such as in Idaho in the big lava fields. There was drilling being done, and about 1,000-plus feet down, they found a little doll when bringing up core samples. And the other point I wanted to make and get your opinion on it is the basic tenets of science is built off of eliminating variables, and I would argue that that's why science is inherently flawed, is because we have no way to test how all the different variables are connected.
What do you think of that, David?
Well, first of all, scientists aren't perfect. I know that. They're human beings just like everybody else. There is a sort of thing called a scientific method, which really no scientist actually follows. Every scientist is an individual. Some are arrogant, some are not arrogant. There's this huge variation, and I know many, many scientists. Most of them are quite humble folk. They work in rather narrow fields. One of the beauties of my job is that I can sort of see the big picture. Most scientists work in a very, very narrow field. They're specialists in one particular thing, and that's what they do. They don't make comments about sort of the universe as a whole, like we're talking tonight. They focus on one very, very narrow area. I can't address particular issues or faults of scientists in particular. I know, of course, mistakes are made, and I know that happens. I'm just speaking generally. I know hundreds of different scientists. Many of them are flawed individually, but they are seekers after the truth. And most scientists that I know, the one thing they want to do is to get at the truth and express that truth. Now, they may make mistakes along the way, but I just have faith in that method. I don't have faith in every individual that's doing it, but I just think that the mission as a whole is a good and a genuine one.
Yeah, absolutely. Next up, let's go to Lee, Syracuse, New York. Hey, Lee, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Lee. Thank you.
I just wanted to tell you about a book and ask you a question here. Did you ever hear of a Dr. Peter S. Ruckman?
I have not. How about you, David?
No, I can't say I have.
He's got a book out called Black is Beautiful on the subject that you're talking about there. I was just going to give you a website if you want to check him out sometime. Would you be interested?
Mm-hmm.
It's www.kjv1611.org. And on the left-hand side, if you click on Works by Dr. Peter S. Ruckman or something like that, you can scroll through all the stuff he's got. There's a lot of other interesting stuff that he's put out you might be interested in, too.
All right, super. We'll track that
okay,
down.
Okay, thank you.
You know, as we were talking about the aliens, a lot of people think that just because they're advanced, they're going to be good. That's not necessarily the case, David, is it?
No, I don't think so. And the only thing we've got to go off is ourselves. You know, we're the only example of technological intelligent life that we know. And we're the result of millions of years of live and let die evolution. We have a natural aggressive streak in us because that's the way we've survived and sort of, you know, risen to the top of the heap, as it were. And I think, you know, other intelligences are going to have gone through the same kind of evolutionary challenges. So they're going to have, possibly eventually, they're going to have a good side to them, but they will also have a survival, aggressive side to them as well. And I don't think that's going to change. However advanced you are, there is going to be that sort of self-interest. So whether you're an out-and-out predator, or, you know, you just have this this need to survive, I don't think you can assume that even a very advanced extraterrestrial will necessarily be entirely benign. I think they might have this sort of self-interest in there as well.
Okay, next up we have Fair Oaks, California, west of the Rockies. Rich, it's your turn on Coast to Coast.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
You know, hey, I'm glad that you gentlemen are there, and I'm glad that you're all in the pink. Thanks. I just want to mention the fact that, when I was, excuse my French, just back in 73, okay, before I went to Vietnam, or I mean, you know, joined the Army.
Okay, I'm going to let you go right now till we can understand you a little bit better, and we'll go back to you here, David, as we check in with you. And what's going on with this scare in Europe over this E. coli? Have you been watching this story?
Yeah. It's a strange thing. I know the Spanish are up in arms because they were initially accused of being the source of it, and now it looks more like it's a German homegrown problem. It's really extraordinary. You don't really think of fresh vegetables as being a source of a dangerous bacterium, but it seems to be that's actually what happened in this case. That it's something to do with bean sprouts on a farm in Germany.
Well, they've changed that. They went from cucumbers to the sprouts, now back to the cucumbers. I don't think they know.
Well, it sounds like it. I hadn't heard. I've not followed the story today. I mean, it's fairly early today. I've not actually read the news this morning, but for sure they don't know. I know the Spanish were very upset about it. We were hoping to get some compensation, and it seems like everybody's sort of trying to pass the buck at the moment.
Right.
But it is extraordinary. You just don't think of that type of food as being a source of that kind of infection. But it just show how susceptible we are to mutant bacteria and viruses.
Well, absolutely. But we shall see. What are the possibilities of a virus coming from a meteorite, from a comet, from something, and just destroying the planet?
Well, the thing is, if an alien bug, and this is one of the reasons that they're always so careful about when they bring stuff back from another world, I mean, particularly the moon in the Apollo, they were very strict on the quarantine measures, because you just don't know what's going to happen. Probably the biochemistry would be different, so we might not even be affected by it. But if it was similar to us and it was a totally new strain, then we would obviously not have any resistance to it. So it could be a disaster. It depends on how what the biochemical basis of the microbe was.
All right, David, we're going to come back and take more phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with David Darling, one of his new works, Mega Catastrophes. It's not even out yet. It'll be out in early 2012, but he has other works as well, including Teleportation and We Are Not Alone, Why We Have Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. We'll come back in a moment. We'll take calls from Germany, Pennsylvania, Florida, Iowa, and the rest of the planet. And if you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Send it, I'll read it, and I might even be able to respond. I'll be back. We're with astronomer David Darling. You've heard what we've been talking about. Let's come back and take your phone calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. David, what's going on at CERN up there in Switzerland? They've been kind of quiet lately as they look for the God particle. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's everything is go there at the moment. They're only running at half power, at present. They won't be turning up the crank to full power until about 2014. They're very optimistic that perhaps even during this year that they'll have evidence of the Higgs boson, as you call it, the God particle, mm-hmm. which is going to be it'll be a fantastic discovery if we find it. It'll be an amazing discovery if we don't find it. Either way, it's one of these issues that a negative is almost as important as a positive. So it may seem quiet, but it's business as usual, and they are churning, they're cranking the data, and certainly within a year or so, I think we're going to hear something pretty spectacular from them.
Are they going to create any black holes if something goes awry?
Well, they may be already creating black holes. It's possible. If they do, they're not necessarily going to be any threat to us, because very, very small black holes, and we're talking about things that are much smaller than an atom, they tend to evaporate very, very quickly. It's a kind of a strange concept, but there's this thing called Hawking radiation and very small black holes. Actually, they don't just grab everything around them. What they do is they tend to actually evaporate very, very quickly, much less than a second before they can sort of swallow the planet. But there are some theories where these micro black holes, if they are created, could survive a bit longer. So we're not entirely out of the woods yet. And the whole thing about the what's happening at CERN is they're breaking new ground. This is new physics. They don't really know what they're going to find. So there's always that element of doubt about the safety of what they're doing, I suppose.
Was it worth spending the billions of dollars that they spent on that?
I think so.
You do?
I think so. In terms of what we're going to learn from it, it's probably a better return on investment than, say, the International Space Station, which costs at least 10 times more. The International Space Station is a fantastic human adventure, and don't get me wrong, I think it's good that we went ahead with it. But in terms of the amount of science that we're going to gain from it, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN is more likely to bring home the goods in terms of furthering our knowledge of the fundamental nature of the universe, and that's what it's all about. If ever we want to travel faster than light or be able to create energy in large amounts from virtually nothing, we have to move along this line to knowing how the universe is built at the super subatomic level.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Germany. Thomas is out there. Hey, Thomas, thanks for calling.
Good evening, George, and morning, David. I tried to get through earlier during your interview with the musical person on parallels between the Mersey Sound and the music of Detroit, but perhaps at some other time. Meanwhile, I'd like to talk about the danger that stellar systems are in from bursts of gamma rays and asteroids and comets and stray planets and so on.
Sure, go ahead.
And because of that, I wonder whether when we search for life in the heavens, we look in the wrong places. In other words, an advanced civilization would probably live as far away from galaxies as possible. So perhaps we're training our telescopes in the wrong direction. I wrote a couple of lines. Take me to the safety of a zone remote from stars, far away from galaxies and nowhere near Mars.
I like that. I like that indeed. You know, you had brought up, David, the possibility of a gamma burst from some system that, could be relatively close by. But I don't know. What is relatively close by?
Well, relatively close by would be within a few thousand light years, which is actually quite a distance away. Anything within about 5,000 light years of us is a potential threat if it happens to be a gamma ray burster and it happens to be pointing in our direction. Like I said about gamma ray bursters, when they go off, they channel all the energy in a very narrow beam. So if the beam is pointing at you, you've got problems if that star happens to be within, say, about 5,000 light years. That's about a 20th of the distance across our galaxy. So many of the bright stars you see in the night sky are within 1,000 light years or so of us, or even much further away than that. If one of those stars goes off, then we could have problems. There are a couple who've been identified that are possibly, there's one that's 8,000 light years away, and a couple of years ago it's called WR104, and it's a big star that's about to blow up. It seemed like its jet might be pointed in our direction. One astronomer said it's kind of like staring down the barrel of a gun, but more recent information suggests that it's actually pointed maybe 30 or 40 degrees away. So if it goes off, we won't bear the brunt of that blast. Some poor alien civilization somewhere else will. But at the moment, we don't see any stars close enough by that are likely to be a problem in terms of gamma ray bursts.
What about Comet Elenin? Any problems here? Any potential disasters for us?
Well, comets are a little bit like asteroids. They tend to be they're showier than asteroids because these are these big long tails when they come around the sun. They look very pretty. They're very, very obvious things. The nucleus of a comet is not so large. And again, it would have to be actually on a collision course with us, a direct collision course to be a real problem. And as far as I know, this one isn't. This one isn't going to intercept us.
Well, that's good. Let's go to Davie, Florida, east of the Rockies. John's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, go ahead.
Yes. Do all galaxies point in the same direction? In other words, the top and the bottom of the spiral, are they similar? Is there a top and a bottom to the universe?
This is a good question, actually. The simple answer to that is no. Galaxies, there are different types of galaxies. Our own galaxy is a spiral galaxy, and an Andromeda galaxy, which is the nearest big galaxy to us, is also a spiral galaxy. Very, very beautiful systems when you look at them in photographs. But when you say pointing, I'm take that to mean the sort of, if you imagine sort of a line drawn through the spiral going upwards, so if it was like a pinwheel, you know, in terms of fireworks.
Yeah, is there an up and a down?
There is really no up and down in space. There is, once you get away from the Earth, where we have a local gravity field, where there obviously is an up and down, once you get into space, there is no up and down. So these galaxies, you look at them, they're tilted in all directions. So unless the universe as a whole is rotating, which is a possibility, we don't know about that, then you could say there was an axis through it. As far as we know, there is no up and down in space.
No, not at all. The vastness of space, too, by the way. I've always wondered what's at the end.
I know. That
it's
was
bizarre.
You know, when I was a kid, I used to dream about this. I always thought maybe it just ends in a brick wall somewhere.
Yeah, you just come to the end.
That was literally one of the dreams I had, that when you got to the end of the universe, there's just this big brick wall there, and you don't know what's on the other side of it. It's just a mystery.
Does it end?
We don't even know whether it ends or not. We don't know whether it's closed in the sense that it's kind of like a ball shape, or whether it's open in the sense of being just infinite.
Would you hit it
forever and
bounce off it? You know, like an inside of a balloon. You know, you're trying to get out.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't bounce off it. You'd just keep going around. If it was closed, you'd just keep going around it. So when you tried to go further and further, your path would eventually just curve around, and you'd eventually come back to where you started from without really knowing it. But if it's open, then you could just carry on forever. We don't even know that. At the moment, it looks like it's on the borderline between the two and possibly infinite extent. In other words, if you just travel out there, you'd just keep going forever. That seems to be the way it actually is.
If you went forever, then there probably wouldn't be multiverses, right?
You can get into another universe if you go down a sort of connection. Say you went down a black hole or a wormhole or something like that, you might end up in a different universe. But in the multi-universe model of where there's sort of, you know, a very large number of universes out there, they're not actually interconnected necessarily. So our universe is big enough that if you just kept on going, you would stay within our universe. You wouldn't just sort of come to the end of our universe and then cross over into another one. You'd actually have to find a space-time tunnel somewhere to go into that other cosmos.
How did you answer that question when you were a kid about hitting the brick wall? I mean, at this point in your career, I mean, what, you still can't answer it, can you?
No, because the human imagination breaks down when you come to these things, and all you can think of is in terms of analogies. So you think, oh, maybe it's like living on the surface of a balloon, in which case, you know, if the universe is closed, it's like the surface of a balloon. So you carry on going forever, you just end up going around the balloon, you come back to where you came from. If it's open, then it's kind of almost easier to imagine, because then you just, you know, the universe is infinite, you just keep on going forever. As a kid, probably what made me become an astronomer in the first case was you know, trying to confront problems like that.
There's got to be an end somewhere. There's got to be an end. I see. That's the logic of feeble thinking.
There's an end to the human imagination, because we have a finite brain, a finite mind. Nature doesn't necessarily comply with the structure of our mind, so it doesn't necessarily have to have an end. We believe it does, because that's the only way we can think. But you know, maybe the universe is structured differently than our own brains.
See, I'm imagining if you come to the end of the universe and you stick your arm through it, it like disappears, and then you pull it back again. That's what I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, your guess is as good as mine on that, George, to be quite honest. Maybe that's the way it is.
You know, it's one of these open-ended theories, and you were talking about, you know, is it worthwhile pumping money into something like the CERN project? And the only way we're going to answer these questions is by experimenting. We're not going to answer it by just thinking about it. We've got to actually go out there and get the data.
Why are we looking for these answers, David? Why do we search? What do we want?
I don't know. We need answers. We all know we're going to die at some point. That's a certainty in life. And I often think that is a primal urge of human beings. Humans are probably the only animals. Maybe chimps have some conception of it. I don't know. But we're really the only ones that know we're going to die. And so if we knew we were going to live forever, maybe these things we could just set to one side and we would just get on with our life. But because there are these very, very personal things that confront us, I think that's what opens up all these questions to us. We want to know what's our role in the universe. What is reality like? Where do we stand? And we know that we only have a finite amount of time, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years in which to answer it. And so we're all personally driven to know why the universe is the way it is.
Let's go to Keene in Tooele, Utah, west of the Rockies. Hi, Keene. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you?
Sure. Good.
George, I'm a longtime listener, and this is my first time calling, and I got through my first time. I cannot believe it.
But
yeah, it's really neat to think about. You know, I don't think there's anybody that hasn't looked up at the sky at night, especially in a remote area, you know, and you just can't help but to think, you know, that there's got to be more than just us. I mean, it's just so huge. But, I just wanted to get to bring something to your attention, and I'll take your comments off the air. I am a member of the LDS Church here in Utah. It's the Mormon Church. And getting back to the subject of technology, I was wondering if you guys, you know, you get pounded with requests and ideas and all kinds of things like that. But one of the main things that kind of validates my interest in the LDS Church is you go back to a man by the name of Joseph Smith. You have to do a little bit of research, but, mid-1800s.
Mormon Church, right?
Yes, sir. He basically translated the Book of Mormon. And from the time he was about 14 years old, you look at a timeline with technology and how that just, like on a like a graph, like a stock chart. You look at that timeline and you can find them on the internet, and it's just amazing. How you were talking about how technology stood still for so many thousands of years, not necessarily stood still, but, you know, just slowly kind of grew. But then over the last 100 years, I think David mentioned just over the last 100 years, how it's just built on itself and just steamrolled. And you look and you can just tie it almost exactly to Joseph Smith and where he places himself in the church.
Okay, I don't know how you can comment on that, David, but were fascinating.
You know, I can't comment on something I'm not an expert on, but I guess maybe he's one of these visionaries who, just the sort of person he is, who's able to capture visions and forecasts and can see where things are going that are beyond the likes of me, for example.
Stephen Hawking lately has been coming up with some strange theories for what he has done in the past. His, you know, discussions about the universe is godless. A lot of scientists, of course, think that. But
yeah.
Stay away from ETs. Well, don't let them know we're here. They could do something to us. What do you think of that?
Well, I think Stephen Hawking's ideas on ET are no more valid than yours or mine, George, to be quite honest. He's a mathematician. He's a cosmologist. He's done a lot of great work on black holes. He doesn't know anything more about God or ET than the guy living next to you or the guy standing next to you in the bar. Quite frankly, these are his personal ideas. He doesn't have any sort of insight in them. He's just expressing his own personal beliefs there. It's not based on any science at all. So I wouldn't, just because he's a big name in science doesn't mean you necessarily have to go along with his ideas just because he expresses them like that. And I don't, for example, happen to believe in what he he says, as far as the danger of ETs is concerned and the absence of God. I don't think he's any more of an expert than anybody else, quite frankly.
Bob is in Alberta, Canada. Let's see if we get you in here, Bob. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. Thanks for taking my call, especially on this one night where you have such a notable astronomer on. David, I know that there's previously only four magnetic field bodies or bodies in our solar system that had magnetic fields. But I've heard, and it's impossible to Google this stuff because, I mean, you can't find any relevant information, but that the magnetic fields, dormant magnetic fields, have become quite active throughout, you know, like several moons and planets throughout our solar system. I personally believe that the magnetic fields play a big part on our climate change. What do you think about that?
The only thing I can comment on that is magnetic field reversals of the Earth. When they occur, which is actually pretty unpredictable, when the North and South Poles switch around as they do and historically have done, there seems to be no pattern to it. It just happens. It seems a rather chaotic process. When that does happen, it will have a big influence on the Earth, because all of a sudden the magnetic field of the Earth will collapse for a certain amount of time. It might only be a few months, a year,
right,
a few years.
And it does happen, as you said.
It does happen. It has happened in the past. In certain periods, it happens quite often. And then it will go millions of years, and it won't switch. So it seems to be sort of something involved with the core of the Earth, currents in the molten core of the Earth. All of a sudden, you know, the whole field will switch around. And then obviously that the magnetic field collapses. We then have no protection from solar radiation. That could lead to problems with life on Earth. That's the only thing I can comment about. I haven't actually heard this story about instability or changes in magnetic fields or holes. Like, I probably can't say anything about that.
The name of David's book is Mega Catastrophes. And again, it's not out until 2012. We're ahead of the game here, but it's a good game. David, thank you so much. He's out there live in the United Kingdom. Up next, a little surprise for you, a Joshua P. Warren paranormal moment.